we have built up a mountain of resilience, whether it's good product trials, bad ones, good funding, funding lost, employee trouble. We've just been able to keep ourselves going because we know we can make a difference if we can just keep pushing.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, it was a pleasure to chat to Rona Toer, the founder of the Lios Group. Rona and Emer started this project way back in 2009 and have worked tirelessly on it ever since. They are developing world-leading technology in the audio and soundproofing space. They're developing products for the European Space Agency. How bloody cool is that? It's a great chat. Rona is super honest, my favorite type of interviewer and my favorite type of entrepreneur. She shares the nuts and bolts of what it's like to actually build a real business from the ground up, the trials and tribulations and all the challenges they faced along the way, right up to their present day of where they are now developing products for some of the world's leading companies. It's a really good chat. We'll get to that in 1 second. I firstly want to thank my three partners for season 7. First up, we've Bay Street Innovation. That's baystreet.io if you want to check them out. Gareth and his team, think of them as your technical partner. So if you are looking for someone to bring some technical chops and wizardry to your business, Gareth and his team will help you, especially useful for non-technical founders. So if you have a vision you want to bring to life, Gareth and his team can help you. They'll also help you automate parts of your business that you find laborious and quite repetitive and find great cost efficiencies there. So that's baystreet.io. Next, we have findavenue.ie. Sean and his team, they're your one-stop shop if you're a corporate event organizer. So if you're organizing a party, a conference, a gathering, anything that brings people together, either in real world or online, they also have a virtual solution. So get in touch with them. They can also sort the entertainment. Basically, just chat to Sean and the team at findavenue if you're looking to book anything for your company in the next year. And finally, chapter.ie. Deirdre and her team in Cork, they're your people if you want to talk to about branding. They have a creative studio based in Cork and they're 360 degree branding specialists. They've worked with people like the Photo Group. They've worked with people like the Everyman Theatre. If you have a branding concept you want to bring from your mind into the real world, or if you're looking at rebranding something, perfect time to do it post-COVID, you need to chat to Deirdre and her team. That's chapter.ie. Now, on to today's chat with Rona. Rona, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You sound very formal there.
This is my first formal podcast recording of the work at home timeframe.
Okay. Well, we'll ease into it. How has the working from home been? We'll start off with that one.
Ooh, how has work from home been? How long do we all have? I think it's been a very different experience for everyone, depending on what kind of home you have, what kind of internet you have, whether you liked where you live, whether you like who you live with, then pile on top of that, that you have to do your day job at home, which I think people thought maybe would be a novelty for the 2 weeks that they told us it would be. And, 13, 14 months later, you're still trying to figure it out. You feel like you probably should have figured it out by then. I think most of us are settling into a routine at this point. I mean, certainly within our company, we've had bursts where everything is great, bursts where everything is the opposite of great. And we're struggling and we can't communicate as well, or, you know, there's something that you want to work on that's really collaborative and you all really want to be in the same room, but you can't. And then someone, mainly me, has a bad internet connection and we can't have the same kind of riff off each other that we used to have. So some of those jobs have become really difficult, or, you know, a project that should take a month takes 6. But, you know, we are working towards having a better work-life setup, and certainly something we're looking at now is how much do we need to be in the office? What kind of work needs to be done in the office? Can we work from home permanently? Can we make that? We absolutely can't, because we actually have lab space and we definitely need the scientists to go in there. They can't do the experiments at home. That would be very dangerous. But who can work from home and what kind of work can we do there? I think it's going to take us a very long time to figure that out. I'm here for any suggestions or recommendations anyone has. We certainly need them, and I don't think we have enough experience all over the world in in setting people up to work from home or setting up your company to be a work remote only. I think there's very certain types of jobs that can do that, and trying to make every job do that overnight is an impossible task.
Yeah, if someone had said to you 15, 16 months ago, going, okay, need you to work on a project now where you're going to move all your candidates and your current staff remote, you'd be like, oh, could take a year, could take two. You know, people have to do it. As you say, 2 weeks, I was chatting to a girl on Friday and she was telling me that she went to her family place for a long weekend and has never left. Because lockdown happened and that was it. Couldn't go anywhere. And then has been working there ever since. And I think we forget that like this has been thrust upon people. And as you say, scientists who have labs, who need to do experiments. People forget that element of things. Tell us about what you do, because you've alluded to it there that you have a lab. So what do you do in the lab?
So what do we do in the lab? So myself and Emer, we're the co-founders of the company, and we have a background in physics. And we have created a technology called SoundBounce, which is a new acoustic material. So it works far superiorly to existing materials. It's thinner. It's potentially more lightweight, depending on what you're looking for. It's non-toxic, which is a really big thing. In acoustics, most things are incredibly toxic. So we're pushing for a more environmentally friendly, sustainable acoustic material future there. So what we're doing in the lab, we've been in business for a very long time now, but this is a very long process to actually make a new acoustic material. So we're still scaling it up. I think people might be surprised to hear that it's still in development, but deep tech doesn't happen overnight. So we have a small version of our technology now, and we're trying to scale it up to big. We have a vision to replace the existing acoustic materials of the past. I mean, it's a technologically stagnant environment. The companies have been around for generations that have been making the foams, and they haven't bothered to make them any better. And in a good way, regulations have come along and people have spoken out saying, you know, noise is impacting the environment. It's impacting people. It's impacting the planet. And also the materials that you're using to make them are so toxic, we can't use them anymore. So you need to do something else. But we're lucky in that we came in ahead of that, and we already knew that acoustic materials weren't good enough. And we started to make something new that would be more sustainable and something that they could evolve into. And the companies weren't innovating while we were. So now they need us to integrate our technology into their components. So we work in the automotive, aerospace, construction, home appliance industries, all of the most glamorous places that you can imagine.
When you say acoustic material, what is that?
Acoustic materials, they can be anything like foams, rubber mats. Most people would think of innovation in acoustics to be digital, so noise cancelling headphones, but you're not going to put the technology for noise cancelling in a building. You're going to put in a big sheet of foam. And for acoustic materials to be good, they need to be really, really thick. And our technology works in the opposite way. It doesn't need to get any thicker. So on average, materials might be, you know, 10 centimeters in thickness, and ours is about 1.
Okay.
And we get superior performance with that same amount of material. So what we're trying to do is to replace all of those materials. So all the foams, the bitumen, the rubber mats, and maybe in some cases the electronic noise cancelling, because we're far cheaper and can do quite a significant job beside them.
Deadly. So what, you mentioned a couple of use cases there. Bring me through a couple of use cases for it.
Sure. Okay. So one of the fun projects that we can actually talk about that we're working on at the moment is with the European Space Agency. In our industry, we don't get to really talk about anything that we work on. So this is a real fun one for us, especially because space is, as we know, the new frontier. So what they currently use in launchers in the nose cone is the area that we're looking at is really large, thick, heavy mats that look like mattresses. Genuinely, they look like mattresses in the nose cone to protect the payload. So what we're not looking at protecting people or your ears at this point. We're looking at protecting the internal equipment from vibrating too much and disintegrating and then getting to space and being useless, which nobody wants. So we're looking at replacing those really thick mattresses with a really thin layer of our material. So something that could be hopefully lighter, which means less fuel consumption, and something that will protect the payload as well better, so that it's guaranteed when it gets up to space that it will not be destroyed.
That is absolutely wonderfully bizarre.
Hmm.
That was not what I thought you were going to say. This is brilliant.
I think a lot of people maybe have some assumptions about what we might work on. I mean, yeah. We started with hearing protection, and that was definitely what inspired us to work on this business, was protecting people from overexposure to loud noise and preventing preventable hearing damage. And when you actually are in business, then you find that maybe the customer that you want isn't actually the customer that will pay you money.
Yeah.
And what we went then towards was big, heavy industry. You know, you talk to a company in heavy industry and you say, we've got amazing hearing protection that we could provide for your staff on site. And they go, you know, my equipment is actually really important to me and it's being damaged by the overexposure to noise on site. Maybe we could do something for the equipment. And we go, yeah, of course. You know, it's the same purpose. It's just in a different package. You know, noise pollution in general. I mean, there's a huge regulation coming, especially in Europe, around noise pollution in cities. Not that we're living in them as much anymore or spending as much time there, but I'm sure we'll be back there. So in your home and in cities, noise pollution will be reduced. And we're hoping to be a part of that solution.
Incredible. You hinted at it there, that you'd had a change. Bring me right back to the very start. How did this all start?
The very, very, very start.
The very, very, very start. Go way back.
Okay, way back. So back 2008, I think, is when our official journey kind of kicks off. My co-founder, Emer, and I are in school together. We are in Sligo, where we're from, and we are doing a young scientist project. And it is somewhat acoustic based. It's about how people tell where sound is coming from, whether you can actually identify it if you can't see it. And the answer is kind of no, as men are actually better at it than women. And as men get older, they get better at telling where sound is coming from. Something we obviously loved hearing when we were doing this project. So we brought this science project to the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition in the RDS. That year, I think we were in fifth year in school at the time. And we won our category, which we were really happy about. And the judges said to us, you know, this is really interesting. We haven't seen a project like this before. You could probably continue your work on acoustics. Maybe you can do something else. And we thought, we're about to do our Leaving Cert next. We're definitely not doing another Young Scientist project. That was incredibly time consuming. And we had the bug, though. So we go back home and we're like, maybe we could do it before the Leaving Cert. Yeah. Maybe we could do it during the summer. And at the time, something that we were both impacted by was ringing in the ears, also known as tinnitus. Emer played the drums in a band. She has these yellow drums, this punk band. And I was going to a lot of concerts at the time. It's just something we were really into was exposing our ears to loud music, to our detriment, because we didn't know that ringing in the ears is actually causing permanent damage to your hearing. And I think most people don't realize that the ringing is not just a fun after effect of your night out. It's actually intense damage to your hearing. So we went about investigating what that was, how it impacted us, why it impacted us, what it did to the ear, and how you could work on improving it. And we investigated a lot of therapies at the time and what was on the market. But I mean, this was 2008. I mean, we hardly had internet at home, so we were working mostly out of books. And we found that there really wasn't a lot of information being provided to people who experienced this, or that what they were being sold was nonsense, really. You know, drink this tea and it will get better. I think we can still see that happening today in certain areas, but the tea is never going to make you better. So we went about creating our own therapy that we would like to listen to and use after we had when we were experiencing tinnitus and that we could use ourselves. And this is what we then brought in 2009 to the RDS again. So we show up and we say, we've created this sound therapy that helps us with our tinnitus, and it seems incredibly effective for us. And we've surveyed 1,000 people and bothered everyone in Sligo Town, and we've had some people try it and we think it's great. So we'd like to show you how it works. And when we were at the exhibition, I know it's a digital exhibition now, but at the time, you know, the public can come in, and hundreds of people were coming to our stand saying, can I have it? I would like to use it. How do I use it? Where are you selling it? And we hadn't expected this. We thought, you know, we would showcase our research and our new technology, and then we would go back to Sligo, so they're leaving CERT, and go on with our lives. But we couldn't. There were too many people who we met who were saying, I need this. My mother needs this. My uncle needs this. My grandmother needs this. You need to give us this. We need access to it. And we didn't really know how to move forward. We couldn't do another Young Scientist project to further our research and bring this to the next phase. We weren't in university. We couldn't get capital there or time to further the research. We had no resources. We were still in sixth year. And we learned then that, you know, if you become a business and you incorporate, you can get finance to set up a company. And that's how you can fund your research. And then you can start to sell your technology, and sales will also help to fund your research. And we thought, great, that sounds easy.
Sounds pretty good. Let's do it. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds very straightforward.
Spoiler alert.
Yes. It was not straightforward. But at the time, you know, we had our youth on our side, and kind of a really fresh naivety that was what a startup needed, that we maybe didn't even realize is what we needed. I mean, certainly I think you don't go into working in a startup thinking, this is going to be really hard and really difficult and be really time consuming and take us a really long time. You think, yeah, of course, I can nail it overnight. But we all know an overnight success probably took about 23 years to actually get on its feet. So we still pushed forward with that though, and we got support from our local enterprise office in Sligo. They gave us our first step up. They gave us a small grant. We incorporated our business on the 1st of May 2009, just before we set the Leaving Cert. That summer, we set up our website, and we had made our first sale by August. So we really hammered it out as fast as we could before going off to college. And I think, you know, if we had known then, obviously this, if we'd known anything about business, we would have done a lot of things differently. But one of the great things about having no experience is that you don't really realize that you aren't getting it right, or that there is a better way of doing it. You just keep pushing until you get it right. So we were lucky in that sense that we could just keep pushing, and we kind of used our science mind of fail, try again, rather than a business mind of fail, maybe you need to do it a different way or someone else can do it. So that September, Emer and I went off to university. I went to UCD to study physics, and Emer moved to Edinburgh, to the University of Edinburgh there to study physics. Yes, we separated. It was tragic for that time. And I mean, we didn't have WhatsApp. We didn't have
people phone. Forget, though, and I think this is worth noting, 2008 is not like it's 100 years ago. That's very recently. We're so used to being connected all the time, like me and you sitting here doing this interview now. A couple of years ago, even 3-4 years ago, this wouldn't be possible.
No, it wouldn't
people
be
forget
possible.
2008, yeah. 2009. How did you make it happen?
It was so difficult, I will say that. I mean, we used to have to schedule our Skypes and try and be home at the same time, but we were first years in college. We had other priorities also.
Yeah, definitely.
And I guess we had no estimation on how important this would become in our lives and how much time it took to run a company. I mean, we were burning the candle at both ends very, very early on. Too much for two people in first year in college, for sure. It was not easy, but we definitely made it work. I mean, we were very tired, but we still pushed forward as best we could.
What were you trying to do that summer? What can you remember back to that first year? What were you trying to do? What were you trying to work on?
So digital health back then was an unknown. I mean, it didn't even have a name. There were no apps. There was no kind of phrase for what we were working on. And what we were trying to do was marketing. We thought, we have made our technology now. We've continued to test it. We're continuing to work on it. You know, we're going to market it, and that's going to be it. That's all we need to do, and that'll be the company. You know, we didn't think there was anything else involved in running the business once we had our platform and that it was live. You know, at that point, I probably didn't know much about accounting or staff or actually marketing in general. I thought, you know, we can put an ad in a newspaper and it will work. So we were learning at that time that was not how it worked. But we didn't really understand why it wasn't working either. I mean, there's so much information now available around setting up a company, startups, how to make a website, what to put on your website, what not to put on your website. I mean, how to get people to come to your website. I mean, Google Analytics, excellent. But we didn't know any of that. So we were truly winging it every day. And at the time, I guess we were trying to get more support as well. You know, we thought further finance would help us and help us to grow. But within about, I think, 12 to 18 months, we had spent enough time talking to our customers, the people that were using the therapy, and they were all just so eager to share how they got their hearing damage. They wanted to know what they could do to prevent it. They wanted to know, you know, how we got ours, you know, what was coming next. And that's when we kind of very quickly started to try to innovate again and say, this is too much, you know, this shouldn't be happening in the first place. Why are these people coming to us from their workplace saying that they have hearing damage when they should be protected in their workplace? And that's when kind of very quickly we started to work on new material again and say, we need to go back to the drawing board and start to protect these people in their work environments, in their home environments, wherever it was that they were experiencing the overexposure to loud noise. And that's when we developed the kind of first iteration of our new acoustic material as kind of a response to say, well, this foam is not doing the job. And, you know, we have physics training, which we didn't have as much as we do now, but we had kind of an alternative approach to research and an alternative approach to how technology can be made. And we had been looking at new materials for a long enough time that we thought this is a way of making a new acoustic material that could absorb the noise that is creating all this damage to these hundreds of millions of people.
What kept you going? Because that's hard to do both. It's hard to go to college. It's hard to run a business. Very, very hard to do both together.
Ignorance in a way. You know, we didn't realize how hard it was while we were doing it. We knew it was hard, but you know, we work really well together. And if it's hard, we just go, well, let's figure it out. It's not, this is really hard, let's move on. And I would say that is almost still true today. You know, I never, now that I look at other companies starting up, I go, oh, that's really hard.
Yeah, it's funny when you look at other people.
You know what you're getting into. Yeah. And you know, it's obviously still very hard to this day. I mean, running a company is very difficult, but we had no idea how hard it was. So that's we just kind of kept ourselves going. And we also knew that we had something that had the potential to have a really big impact. And that is what keeps us going now.
Okay.
You know, that determination to say, we can change this. We can disrupt this industry. We know we have the technology to do it. Sometimes maybe we don't have enough people, enough time, or enough money, but we can do it. We just need to persist. And we have built up a mountain of resilience in all of the ups and downs that we've had on our journey, whether it's good product trials, bad ones, good funding lost, employee trouble. You know, we've just been able to keep ourselves going because we know we can make a difference if we can just keep pushing. But it is also still ignorance today where I say, oh, it'll be easier tomorrow. It'll be easier tomorrow.
I think you need that though, because otherwise if you knew what you're getting into, you'd never start. I think you need that naivety, even as you get older and you need to get more experience, you still kind of keep that naivety in you. I think it's an entrepreneur thing. You just keep that naivety.
Yeah. I'd be afraid if I told myself what I was about to, the gauntlet I was about to run. And I don't know if I would be as brave to start it, even though I don't feel worried ever on it. I mean, I'm just like, it's just a challenge that we need to overcome. And that's every day. There's always a new challenge. But yeah, it's definitely, I think, a frightening concept if you can see your journey ahead of you before you start it. But I wouldn't put anyone off going on that journey either. I mean, it's certainly a very unique way of going through your career and your professional life. But I mean, it's made every single day very interesting and very different.
One step at a time. How did you, so you kept it going right through college, and then did you both go straight into the business, or what way did you manage that?
Well, we could say Emer went all the way through college.
Okay.
Yes, Emer has a master's in physics and she is our CTO and incredibly smart. But around halfway through third year, it was too much for me. And also the business was just taking up too much time. It was one or the other. And my lecturers knew that as well. They knew what I was working on. They were like, this is not sustainable. And I thought, of course it is. I can keep going, but I absolutely could not. So I took a sabbatical halfway through third year. Here we are. I don't know, 8 years later.
They're waiting on that email for you to come back.
Yeah, any day now, I'll go back and it'll be so easy to just...
How did you make that decision though? Because that's a biggie. How did you come to that decision?
You know, it was very difficult. And it was very difficult just admitting it to people. You know, I admitted it to myself much quicker. I knew I could do the business, but I knew I couldn't do both. And it was more sitting everyone down around me who knew me and saying, I think I'm going to leave college and don't freak out.
I think that went down well at home.
You can imagine. I think most people thought, you know, this is a phase. She'll go back to college in a year. You know, this
is like starting a band or something.
Yeah, she's sitting at home in her pajamas for a year in front of a laptop, tinkering away, and she'll be back here in a few months. You know, and that was really tough as well, because back then, you know, what was it? It was 2011, 2012. You know, being a young entrepreneur wasn't a thing, and we were laughed at. And
middle of a recession as well.
In the middle of the recession, I mean, there was no money, there was nothing, and people weren't really spending money either. So why were you trying to sell them something? And why were you trying to make debt for yourself as well? I mean, we had so much that we wanted to do for the business, and running a company costs a lot of money. How are we going to do it? But yeah, it was a tough thing to admit. It was something that I really wanted to do, but not something I could nearly do openly, because it wasn't, I mean, it's, you're hailed now almost as a young entrepreneur, like you're a genius, you're a prodigy, and you can do anything. And there's obviously a lot more assistance as well for young people who are trying to start up now. You know, there's more supports, there's more accelerators, there's more programs you can do. You can do entrepreneurship in college. Mm. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
But back then it was, she's lost the plot.
How did you feel? Can you remember how you felt that first day after you started on your own after college, right? College is over, right? We put that semester behind us now. How did you feel that first day of, okay, now this is all it?
I felt really content, actually. I can remember I had this teeny tiny laptop. We couldn't even afford a big laptop. I had this little micro laptop. I remember sitting down and being like, oh, I can just work on my work now, you know?
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about college. And that was always a really big worry for me, because I thought, you know, we were brought up in the generation that was, you must go to college, you must get a degree, and no, you'll probably never get a job, but you still must do it that way.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was for me. I'm not as academic as I'm not successfully academic in that way, and I am much better at doing a job. And I felt really in control And it was great. It was for the first time I thought, okay, what a relief. I don't have to worry about trying to do it all and trying to have a degree to justify being able to work on my business instead of just working on my business.
What happened next?
Wow.
Such an expansive, take that where you want.
in a summary, I worked at home. I was the original work from home. For a while, and for about 2 years, I think. And Emer finished her degree in Edinburgh, and I really wanted to get her back to Ireland. So when I took my sabbatical, we got funding from Enterprise Ireland, the CSF funding, which I think most Irish startups might go through, which is 50 grand so that you can try and live off it and build a product at the same time. A small amount, but it definitely enabled me to take that leap, to leave college, and also to build our first prototype and to test it and find out that it worked better than we thought. We were onto something. But there's only so much you can do with one person sitting at home with a computer trying to build prototypes at the same time. So I knew I really needed to get Emer home, and I said I need Emer's help, and I need her to come home. And I need to convince her that there's enough of a job here that she doesn't just go and get a job after college.
Were you worried?
Of course, yes. She was going to have a master's in physics and she could do whatever she wanted. She was a genius. And I needed that genius here. but I knew Emer was committed to growing the company as well. I needed money to be able to pay her to come home. I think a lot of people... assume maybe you have another job on the side when you set up your company first, and maybe you do it at the weekends. But
that is funny, that conception. That is funny. Yeah,
it is a conception. No, you can't. It is a full-time job is a full-time job, and running your own company is double that, and you need to be able to sustain yourself. And I think the money that people try to get you to live off, when they give you these small grants, or you do an accelerator and you have 50 grand, but maybe there's a team of four of you. What do they expect you to be living off? Do you have another job? Are you a consultant on the side? How do you pay for rent or bills, or do you have a family? And, that's really, I think, underestimated when it comes to funding startups. They say, well, this is the money for the company. And I'm like, and I also am an employee that needs to live and survive. Yeah. So I needed that amount of money. I needed that much money to be able to bring her home and have her help. So I went out to look for money. And I think looking for money in Ireland is, as we all know, a very difficult process at times, depending on what kind of company you're running. We were turning into a product manufacturing company, and it'd be much more of a friendly environment, I think, if you're working in SaaS here. There's more money for that. But people were allergic to hearing our pitch.
It's a great word. Very descriptive.
Yes. And that's how it felt when I was in the room. And also I was by myself. I was 20. I had just left college, and I said, I have this amazing idea, and I would like all of your money so I can bring my best friend home from college and we can build this here. You can imagine how it went down. But it comes back to, my biggest learning throughout this whole process is having the relevant people working with you as your partners or your mentors or your investors. And I think regularly, in Ireland, we talk about how great we are when it comes to supporting startups and companies and having great access to mentors and scaling. But it's for a very specific type of company. And I think you need to look at what kind of business you are and then say, well, I need this kind of help. I don't just need whoever is available. And, that was definitely the challenge we had in that I was kind of going around a circuit presenting with companies that were a similar age to ours, at a similar level of growth, but they were pitching an entirely different vision. They were saying, in 12 months' time, we'll have 100,000 users and X revenue. And I was going, maybe in 6 to 7 years, we'll have a product.
That's what they really want to hear. That gets investors real excited.
So excited. They like, so your time to market is extensive. Yes, it's incredibly long, our time to market, and what we're trying to build and disrupt is something much, much bigger than I think we even realized at the time. You know, I said it very ambitiously, like, this is going to be the next big thing, but it's going to take me a long time. I'm not sure how long it's going to take, but I know I need some more money, and I need more support. I can't do it by myself, no matter how hard I tried. So we were lucky to end up presenting in a room full of investors and to find the right one, someone who thought what we were doing was incredibly interesting, that could see that it was a long-term vision and that wanted to help us sort our shit out, essentially. And that, you know, we were young, we didn't know much about running a company. We didn't have the support of having been through an accelerator program. I didn't really know anyone in the startup community. I probably didn't even know it existed at that time. And when we found the right investor and got the injection of capital that we required, I was able to bring Emer home, hire our first team member, move into an office, and get really serious about growing the company.
You mentioned there the right kind of people and the right kind of investor. What does that look like? How do you spot a good investor as a young startup? Because I literally was reading a story on Twitter yesterday, Pat Phelan put it out, about sharp practice, we'll call it kindly, of investors moving goalposts last minute, demanding board seats, demanding very stringent policies on their startups. How do you find a good investor, and what does that look like?
They don't ask for that. I mean, I've been in the room where they've asked for that as well. There's been lots of inappropriate questions at a variety of different times. They don't want to be paid to sit on your board. I mean, stop talking to that person. It is somebody who just believes in you. And I think, you know, for our investors, they have believed in Emer and I throughout this entire process. When things are going well, when things are a bit bumpy, when things are incredibly topsy-turvy, they still think, you know, you're going to get through this. And that kind of blind support is the support that we have for ourselves that we kind of need to keep us pushing forward. But when it comes to advice and actually building the company as well, I mean, we spent a lot of time talking to people who have built completely different businesses, saying, well, you need to be here and you need to be achieving X, or for the age that your company is, which is obviously very old because we incorporated when we were babies, you're not going to get there. And, you know, we used to take that to heart and go back to the office and say, oh my God, are we going to fail because we haven't reached this KPI that has absolutely nothing to do with what we're trying to achieve? And that was really tough for us because this was the environment that we were in, and the people we were surrounded by were giving us the wrong advice. And it took a really long time for us to figure that out and for us to find that maybe there weren't the right people here that we could talk to. But when you talk to them now, you can instantly feel, well, that's really relevant. I'm going to implement that immediately. Mm. And that's what you should be thinking when somebody gives you advice. You should say, I'm actually going to do that. Not really. And you shouldn't, if someone's asking you for shady terms, I mean, walk away. There are so many investments and investors that we have spoken to throughout this entire process that have asked shady questions, asked for shady terms, lowballed us because they didn't have the same ambition that we did. You know, we were pushing to try and get that money because when you're a startup, you need the money. You have to get the money. And as in my job, that's all I'm generally doing is fundraising. And you kind of get these blinkers on that say, well, this person's talking to me about giving me money, so I'm just going to run and take it.
Yeah.
And then they ask things like that. And you go, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The company needs money. The company needs money. And that is your only goal, when really you should be running away from those people because you shouldn't take their money. They'll be really toxic if they're on your board. They'll suck money that they've just given back from you. They want to drain your equity, which means that by the end of this, maybe you'll get nothing. So what was even the point? And try and have too much of an influence on what you're actually working on. And you want someone who isn't trying to steer the agenda. You want them to go, yes, you've made a good decision there. I appreciate the research you've done. And this seems sensible. Not, well, in my experience of this other company that's totally different and irrelevant, they did it this way, so you should do it that way. And I'm going to force you to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the point?
Advice is one of those funny ones. Like, people rarely try give you bad advice, but they only give you advice based on their own experience. And as you said, often it's completely irrelevant, but they're trying their best to help you. But if they only know SaaS or they only know consumer, it's not. And that's the thing. I've been in the exact same position where people have given you advice and you're like, oh God. And you change your entire strategy.
Yeah.
You change your entire strategy. So once you got the funding and you got Emer home, bring us up to speed, then what happened next?
Oh God, we're so far away from the end. So Emer comes home, brilliant. I don't have to worry about every single element of the company anymore. And we hire our first team member who is still with us today, which is just amazing. And we have an office, and we think then we kind of think we should go down the traditional path, and we look to do an accelerator so that we can learn how to be a business, even though we'd been in business for a long time. And, you know,
here we go.
and we join an accelerator and we meet some incredible companies who we still share an office with at the moment. If we could go into it, we still share an office with them. You know, the best thing that we've ever done is peer learning. I mean, companies who are at a similar stage to you, trying to achieve similar things, but probably in a totally different market. I mean, that's who you can learn from, especially in the founder position. You know, who have you talked to? Who have you not talked to? Who was useful? Who was irrelevant? Where can you get money? Where can I spend a long time looking for money and actually never get it? And, you know, you can really, really level up very quickly when you're working in a peer-to-peer environment, I think. And we went from working in an open plan co-working space to a co-working space where everyone had their own door. So we shared a kitchen, and it's we've been there actually ever since. And it's one of the best decisions we made for the company. We did an awful lot in that office. But yes, we joined the accelerator to learn about business and pitching and PowerPoints and where to focus our time, where not to focus our time. And we learned more about ourselves in that accelerator than we did, I think, about the business. You know, we were in an environment with, was it 10 other companies, and they were all doing totally different things. And you can definitely get very confused about what you should be focusing on when in that environment, to think, oh, well, they're doing this, so maybe should I do that? When really you shouldn't pay attention to what they're doing, but you should pay attention to the processes they put in place, the way that they hire their staff, maybe how they manage their accounts, you know, how do they do their budget? They're working off a similar amount of capital to you, you know, you can learn more from each other there. And when we left that environment, we kind of knew what kind of business we wanted to be after that. And we wanted to work in our own room with no distractions and no ping pong. And we kind of knew what was to come next. You know, what, well, we thought we knew. I mean, it took an awful long time to get there, but we had established what we thought we should look like. And we made some choices about our business model, which we changed, and that really helped us as a company as well. So when we moved to the co-working space, or the offices with co-working space, I think we've dubbed them the resilient years. you know, it was a roller coaster of up and down. And
what year was this?
This, I think, is about 2015.
Okay.
I would say 2015 through 2018.
Okay.
They're the resilient years, where we had the technology was in a good place. We had done lots of external testing. We had built the prototypes that we needed. We had really refined who our customer was. And that was at the point where it was at this point that we had moved from trying to sell to individuals to selling to corporates, and realizing that the technology wasn't just going to be in a hearing protection headset, but that maybe it could line a building. And that was the kind of big jump that we were
making. That's a massive jump. How did you come to that realization?
we talked to the customers and we said, we want to sell you this. And they said, no. I mean, what a lesson. Definitely talk to your customers. They might not want what you have, or they might want it in a different way. And for us, it was a bigger and better way. I mean, if we were still selling hearing protection, we would be a much different company. We'd be not having the impact that we might have today, and probably wouldn't have been on the journey that we've been on now. So, yeah, trying to change from selling a very small type of technology to a much more disruptive, impactful one, makes you relook at how you need to grow your company. Mm-hmm. And we knew we needed a lot of money. Don't we all need a lot of money? But we knew we needed a huge injection of capital, and we tried to get it here. Mistake number one. You know, we were trying to talk to investors that were familiar with SaaS technology, or looked at us as a digital health company, or didn't really understand what we were trying to do, and thought the companies we were trying to sell to, their time to market was too long. And of course, I mean, time to market in auto could be 5 years, and aero-ish could be up to 10. But you start working with the company much sooner than that, and you start making revenue much sooner than that as well.
Okay.
So it's not all, well, we will work on this for 10 years and then it will be in space. It's, well, there will be joint development, and there will be integrations, and there will be a structured development process. And I mean, the cars that are going to be on the road are in development now for the next 5 years. Mm. So you have to kind of be ahead of what's coming. So we had a lot of disappointments in those years, where we got incredibly close to closing funding rounds that were, we thought, you know, going to be the most significant thing for us, that would be our ticket to success, essentially. But I think, as I've mentioned, they were definitely going to be the wrong investors for us. Okay. They were just here and they were talking to us, but the terms were rubbish. The capital wouldn't even probably have made enough of an impact for us, and they would have tried to have too much of an influence over the company. So at the time, you know, it was a devastating blow for us to get so close. And I mean, by close, I mean paper in hand, ready to sign.
Wow.
And then deciding it's a no twice. You know, very tough. And for me, obviously, then it's, you know, it's 2 to 3 years worth of work in the toilet. And you know, you can't just be like, oh, well, I'll try that other thing I was working on at the same time. You know, you're pumping all your energy into this funding. And I think any startup CEO out there has probably been through a similar process, or I would hope so that I don't feel so alone in that failure.
Are you talking considerable sums as well?
Yes. You know, the kind that will get you to the next phase.
Everyone's Googling you as we speak, by the way. Everyone's Googling the company name as we speak.
happy to help anyone if they ever need it. But yeah, that really, it taught me and Emer a lot. And that's where the resilient years kind of built this determination into us that said, we are going to do this, come hell or high water. Whether they want to be involved or not, we're just going to have to figure out another way.
And how did you keep that though? Because that sounds great now, and it sounds great in a poster on my wall, but how did you keep that?
So what we, Emer and I do is we take turns. One day she's pessimistic and I'm optimistic. And then the next day I've listened to what she said and I'm pessimistic and she's optimistic because she listened to what I said.
Yeah, and I love that. That's true. Very common among joint entrepreneurs. I hear that a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's really interesting, actually. I haven't talked to enough kind of partnered co-founders to understand their dynamic, but I think
generally that's, you know, what I hear. When he's up, I'm down. When she's up, I'm down. When I'm down, she's up. Yeah, it's generally what you hear. So it's interesting.
That's amazing, because it's the most important relationship in your life at that time. And I know people say, you know, your co-founder, it's like getting married, but it's more than getting married. You know, your livelihood depends on this person. You know,
only a founder would understand that last statement. It is 100% true. Yeah.
You know, it's not just that, you know, you're very close and of course you're legally tied to each other, but you literally, whether you can buy groceries depends on whether the other person shows up to work the next day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm so committed to making this business successful for Emer, and she is so committed to making this business successful for me, that we are just pushing really, really hard all the time for each other. And, you know, I can see that in her every day in work, and I hope she can see the same in me. And, you know, also when you have a bad day, that's okay as well, because I mean, Emer and I have been friends since we were 15. We know everything about each other, about our families, what anyone is going through at any one time, how well we work, what we like, what we don't like, what we're going to be able to tick off our list really, really quickly, and what we're maybe going to struggle with. And kind of knowing that also really helps us kind of push through those harder moments where I know she knows what I'm working on, I don't like, and that it's going to take me a bit of time. But she's going to cut me some slack for that reason. And she also knows what I'm really, really good at and what she can ask me for that will be perfect no matter what. And those resilient years really needed that, because some of the days were really, really tough. And you know, you needed to still push forward for the team, and you needed to still be working on building the technology. And you're still talking to customers every single day going, yes, we will have the funding and we will be able to build this for you. Come back to me very soon. And it definitely, it's got us to a point now where almost nothing can phase us. You know, you might have a really big challenge in work, but we go, it's fine. We know we can get through it. We've gotten through so much more than this, or had much more difficult conversations, and been able to show that we can pull ourselves out of it. So we were still looking for that really large injection of capital all throughout this time, even though we were getting knocked down a lot. And people were telling us that we needed to go outside of Ireland to look for it, that no one would fund us here. And I found that kind of a really funny statement, because you think I should get this money, but you won't give it to me. You think someone else should give it to me. And I'm like, okay, that's really helpful. If you could all write that down together, and I'll hand it to the magic person that will give us the money. But we did find that entity that would give us the capital, and that was the EU. So we have European Commission SME instrument funding. Not a light process to take on, but definitely an excellent place to get capital for a company that needs a large injection of money for research and development that isn't necessarily working off an instant return KPI style company. So we got 2.3 million from the EU in 2019. And that has enabled us to grow to the scale that we want to. So it's the funding from the European Commission is funding for ambitious technology development, and that's certainly what we've always been working on, you know, trying to fundamentally disrupt an industry, or trying to research something that you think could that's the kind of money that they give to companies that can't get it elsewhere. It's supposed to try and compete with US funding. You know, if we went to the US, there would be a lot more money available to us. And I mean, certainly I went over there, but realized very quickly that we would be getting the wrong kind of money if we stayed there. You know, our customers aren't there. They're here, they're in Europe, they're in Asia. And we would be building a different kind of company if we had taken Silicon Valley money. So this was definitely the right money for us, and it was very difficult to get it. You need to be incredibly organized. You need to have a very well thought out plan. You need to know where every penny is going to go. But we always had one. So it was the right fit for us at that time. So we wanted to set up a full scale lab. We wanted to expand our marketing, our organization structures, and kind of rapidly grow the company. But that was June 2019 that we got the capital, and we started to grow our team of scientists, you know, kind of poaching people out of academia into industry jobs. We had acousticians, chemists, mathematicians, and just as we were getting going in our lovely new lab, the pandemic hit, and we all had to put our screens in bin bags and take them home.
Wow.
So we feel like we were just getting that momentum. And I think we had the week that we were sent home, I think Emer and I had maybe three different flights booked for different meetings. And oh, wow. there was so much happening. It was like a really busy time for us. And we were about to start a lot of integration projects across a range of industries. And, you know, all of those teams were furloughed and we never got to go to the countries to start the projects. And we had to completely change and adapt how we were working. And, you know, our lab's closed. So then you have to have researchers at home and say, so what are we going to have you work on while you are not in the lab? And really kind of upside down what you're working on. So we had to kind of flip a lot of the work we had planned for maybe a year from now and say, okay, we're going to research this piece and bring that forward and move that back and try and come out of this phase that we thought would be really short, you know, a lot tougher with refocused work and kind of make better changes to our plans. And, you know, overall, I think we did. You know, it was definitely wasn't an easy process. And I think there was things that everyone could have done better, but you know, we're well settled into it now. And we're back in our lab and we're back doing virtual projects.
Great.
And the staff are coming off furlough in the other companies. So, you know, things are finally picking up. I think maybe just it took a little bit longer than we all anticipated. But it definitely forced us to learn a lot more about ourselves as individuals and learn a lot more about our team and how they work and why they work and how they work best. And we've done a lot of work in that space as well to figure out how to get the best out of everyone while we are at home. But it has not been, I'd say, an easy 12 or 15 months for any company out there trying to scale a company or anyone that took in a lot of money just before this happened to execute a plan that got blown to bits.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, by the way, because I think that's important for people to understand. There's a lot of kind of very, very pro or very, very negative kind of propaganda coming out after COVID going, oh, we scaled 1,000% during COVID. And that's grand if you're an e-commerce brand, but people forget about companies like yourself who are heavy, intensive R&D, who literally need to be sitting at the machine or on the line or whatever it is to get their product made or to bring it to market. And I think that's a really important lesson. But it sounds like you're primed. It sounds like you're just priming the gun for that momentum to kick that back off again. So what does the next 12 to 24 months look like for yourselves as you kind of come out of COVID?
So for us, I mean, we're starting manufacturing, which is a huge thing for us. We've been talking about doing it since probably 2010, manufacturing at a large scale, the technology for the first time ever. So we have our project with the European Space Agency. So we're doing our first kind of in a product trials as well at the end of the year. So
that must be incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting way of looking at how something that you build can end up being utilized in industries you'd never actually looked at. And I think in Ireland, actually, we do a lot more in space than people realize. And a lot of companies here are working on some excellent things that are being sent over to the European Space Agency and further afield. And, you know, maybe look at your technology and see, does it have an application in space? You'd be surprised what they utilize. So the next 18 months are all about manufacturing and scale for us. We are trying to get into as many products as we can. So home appliances, automotive, working on those projects that we thought we'd be working on last March, and finally executing them. And I think we have really high hopes for what we're going to achieve in the next 18 months. And we hope that we can kind of maintain the current momentum that we have. We've kind of settled into a labs are half open, everyone's working at home. We think this is as much as we can do and grow the company at the same time. And hopefully there's no major changes to that. Of course, if everything went back to normal, we would be ramping up as well. But, you know, we've settled into a this is achievable. Let's try and achieve this and not overextend or overexpect anything. I mean, certainly we've had issues in getting things shipped during COVID as well. I mean, you know, you might think something's going to land in your office in 2 weeks and it takes 8. So you've had to just expand the entire timeline to make the same level of progress, but that's what we've been working on. Slowing it down, not trying to run too quickly, trying to just take the small steps to achieve what we initially planned and complete our kind of scale up goal.
Two final questions for you before I let you go. We're almost at the hour. So, how do you plan your week and your quarter?
Oh, my week is incredibly detailed, almost hour by hour.
Good, yeah.
Which is something that I only started since working from home, was because I couldn't differentiate the time. Mm. And either you'd spend all day at the desk or all day on calls, and you'd never really see what you had worked on. So now I have an hour by hour planner with a to-do list beside it that says, you know, this is realistic. Sometimes it's unrealistic as well. But, you know, these are the realistic things I can achieve, and this is how my day is filled out. So either you're all on calls all day and you can't achieve anything, or you're not, and this is what you need to get through. So it's very detailed at this point. And I would say that comes from a very kind of unorganized place when we first moved home, because things were a bit more frantic and you didn't know how much time you would spend on the phone, which is up to 10 hours a day.
Wow.
And, you know, you didn't then factor in how you would do the other work and how much more time you need to spend talking to your team. So I would say for anyone that's struggling, get an hour by hour planner and figure out what your capacity really is, because mine was a lot lower than I realized. I was trying to fit in way too much, and that's why it was all building up and never getting done. And this has really enabled me to start to improve. By the quarter, I mean, it's all, we have it planned out for the next 12 months. Everyone knows what they're doing at all times. Sometimes we have a system where we set up 100 days and we say, what are you going to do in the next 100 days? And people have to fill those out, each individual in the team, so they know what they're going to achieve in 3 months. But mostly we have kind of long running projects that are in our project management system, and it's convoluted, and we have long-term goals that have kind of been worked back into chunks. So it's all planned out from now until this time next year.
I love already. That. It's always interesting to get an insight in someone that's so busy and how you actually break that down. I love the hour by hour. I do the same. If it's not in Google Calendar, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
What is there a book that has made an impact on you personally or professionally?
Ooh, a book. I do a lot of reading. How I used to commute. I used to commute via the Dart into town and would consume a lot of books, but I used to never actually read business books, because I felt I needed the brain space to think about anything other than work.
It can really be any kind of book. It can be fiction. It can be just one you really enjoyed. Anything.
Yeah, I really do admire people who can read business books, because I think, you know, they're able to level up on their downtime. I can say two books. I'm going to say two books.
Go first.
One book that helped me on our journey throughout this time when things were really difficult during the resilient years is a book called Brotopia. I think the woman who wrote it, I think it was Emily Chang, but I think I would need to check that.
Brotopia.
Brotopia.
Okay, I'll put in the notes.
It's a book about running a company in Silicon Valley and just how kind of distorted and toxic the environment can be sometimes, but that, you know, that's not normal. That's not what it should be like. And you can step out of that. And knowing that we weren't alone in our struggles there, it really helped us to get through that difficult period for us. So I'd say that's a book from the resilient years that really helped us to stay determined and not feel too beat down. A book that I really enjoy personally is The Malay Archipelago by Alfred Russel Wallace, which is a really, really old book about the origin of species, and maybe a bit heavy going for someone, but if you want something to completely escape your day-to-day, this is about a man who's traveling around Borneo and discovering the way that we evolved back in the day.
Brilliant. Two very different reads. I think the first one will be very relevant for people at the minute in terms of the resilient years. Sound like we're all kind of going through that at the minute. Where can people learn more about you and the company?
Me and the company, you can check out our LinkedIn. You can also check out my LinkedIn. If anyone ever needs help, feel free to reach out. We are very open and eager to help anyone that's trying to get through this same topsy-turvy journey that we are all on. And you can also find us on Twitter at Lyos Group or myself at Rona Toher.
Perfect. Rona, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gary. This was super.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Rona. I think her and Emer are building something very, very special there, and I'm excited to see what's going to happen in the next couple of years with them. Keep an eye on them. If you want to check them out, that's lios-group.com. I will see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab. Until then, have a brilliant week.